Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today we have a special edition of Hometown Alaska called Justice Alaska. We have four Justice Alaska shows planned for this spring, one each month, with each show taking a consumer-friendly look at how our courts, our laws, and our system of justice works. Our topic today is how Alaska chooses its judges. We got to this topic by noticing the national headlines over replacing Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. Alaska has an opening on its own Supreme Court, so we'll be having the same stories happening here. Also, the news today included the information that Merrick Garland is a Supreme Court nominee, so that's going to be in the news. So what's going to happen with Alaska's Supreme Court? That's one of the things we're going to talk about. With me in the studio is co-host and legal expert, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Welcome, Judge Andrews.
Thank you so much. A real pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And Judge Andrews, you have been both a district court judge and a superior court judge and served in the justice system for several decades. You're definitely a legal expert. You're also my co-host, so welcome. And you've invited a guest to help us with today's topic. So why don't you go and introduce your guest?
So Suzanne DiPietro is the executive director of the Alaska Judicial Council. And Suzanne, can you tell us what that is and what you do for them?
Sure. Thanks, Elaine. And it's great to be here. So I work for the Alaska Judicial Council. The council is seven citizens who play a very important role in nominating people who want to be judges in the state.
You know what? I want to just briefly interrupt and throw out our phone numbers because we really do welcome calls, and this is really a public information show. So let me just throw those out there, and then we're going to pick right back up, Suzanne. If you're interested, you know, if you want to ask us a question about today's topic, or we're even open to ideas, we've got lots of ideas for what the show can be going forward. But we'd love to hear what you're interested in, too. So 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide. Or we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So jump back in, Suzanne. I'm sorry I had to do that, but I just want to make sure we got the numbers out.
Sure, great. So anyway, I just really briefly, I came to Alaska back in 1987 out of law school. I came to clerk for a judge. And working in the court system, I started to notice that the legal system, the court system, particularly the judges here, were very different than where I'd gone to law school, where they have a system of electing judges. And we don't have that system here. I got curious about it. And the more I studied it and learned about Alaska's merit selection system, the more interested I became. And all these years later, here I am at the Judicial Council, helping to fulfill the constitutional mandate with the council members of selecting our judges.
So why do we have a judicial council?
Well, that's a great question. So the Judicial Council was actually established by our constitutional framers when they met up at the Constitutional Convention up on the Hill at Fairbanks University. The Judiciary Committee had the task of looking at all the other states, you know, coming to statehood late as we did. We had the advantage of looking at all the other states and how they were doing things and finding out who was doing it well and who wasn't. And the Judiciary Committee settled on the so-called merit selection system. It's also called sometimes the Missouri Plan. And that's a system that emphasizes the qualifications of people who want to be judges. And then on the to respond to the idea of judges being accountable to the public, the founders also envisioned a system of retention elections where a judge would, after serving a term in office, would run on their own record and get a yes or no vote from the people.
Mm-hmm. I was interested because I was reading there's like a 3-year window when they're appointed and then they come up for retention. And then I think Supreme Court justices have a 10-year term, but they come back up, right?
Yes, yes.
And I think Superior was 3 years, then a retention, and then they have an 8-year term and then they come back up. And then I think district was maybe there's a court of appeals in there somewhere. So, but anyway, yeah, it always comes back around. And so if there's a reason to consider this person not continuing, there's that opportunity. So it's not a lifetime, which with the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court is lifetime.
And federal judges are
federal judges are lifetime.
That's not the system in Alaska.
Yeah.
We have this merit selection and retention. And this is certainly a timely topic today with nomination by the president of a potential U.S. Supreme Court justice. And obviously, the headlines are full, but we're going to focus today on Alaska. And Suzanne, maybe you can explain why we are unlikely to have and would
those
not
headlines,
have those headlines and
that debate.
And that debate.
Well, sure. So in Alaska, we have a very, the Judicial Council has established a very transparent and clear process for applying to be a judge. So the legislature sets certain requirements, certain basic requirements to be able to apply, having to do with how long you've lived here and how long you've practiced law. And then the Judicial Council has an application process. And this application, which you could look at on our website, is actually about 25 pages long.
35 questions. I looked.
Yes.
It's amazing. Yes.
Yes. A tip for people who are thinking of lawyers who are thinking of applying, start early. Yeah. And the Judicial Council announces when there's a vacancy. So, for example, when Justice Fabe announced her retirement, the Judicial Council announced when it was going to be filling the vacancy. And there's laws about how long the council has to do that when there's a vacancy. So we won't have that situation where we might wonder if the seat is going to be filled. We know exactly when it's going to be filled.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to point out our website, alaskapublic.org and Hometown Alaska. We've included the Judicial Council's website, but also some things that Suzanne pointed out. There's a very short 2-minute video, easy to watch, that explains how our judges are. So if you just want the short version, you can get that. There's just lots of information on your website. One question I have for you is, do you consider lawyers your audience for that website, or do you consider the public the audience for that, or both?
Both. Okay. We hope that the public will visit our website. We try to post a lot of information on our website because we feel that people have the right to know about the qualifications of the people who've applied and been nominated for judgeships. And then on the flip side, we hadn't talked about this, but the council also by law evaluates the performance of judges who are sitting.
This is that part where they come back up for
what
thumbs
we call
up or thumbs
retention,
down.
Thumbs up or thumbs down by the voters. And so the idea there from the legislature was, well, it would be good if voters had some information upon which to make their decision about whether the judges are doing a good job or not, and ask the Judicial Council to evaluate their performance. And we do that as well. And we make that information available to the voters.
Mm-hmm. And that information is also in the voter pamphlet that goes out to all voters. So at the back of the pamphlet, there are pages and pages that have the information about who the judge is and how the judge was rated by the people who were rating them.
Right. I mean, how would you like to have everybody you work with in your profession also rate you when you apply for? But on the other hand, it's a very important job, and that's part of the process. So, yeah.
Exactly.
I was looking on the website because it was new to me. I haven't really explored the Judicial Council's website, but I did in preparation for the show, and it was amazing. Like, you can see for years past who's applied. You know, you can see their ratings. You can see you could do a term paper here very easily on the Judicial website. And I think it has gravitas, I guess, is the way I thought about it. It's they have to disclose a lot, but it's because it's very important. So
exactly.
Yeah. The mission, you've kind of talked about it. It's the selection of judges. It's also review and retention. You're protected in the Constitution. This office. Is the funding ever variable for you, or is it guaranteed?
Well, no, of course, under our structure of government, funding's never really guaranteed. The legislature is the appropriator. And so even though the Judicial Council is within the judicial branch of government, not within the executive branch or the legislative branch, the legislature appropriates. But the council is established in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And so it would be assumed that we would want the council to have some amount of funding to be able to fulfill its constitutional responsibilities.
Right. And is that an issue, or is it generally you're well-funded? You feel comfortably funded?
I would not say that any state agency,
ever
the Judicial Council included, really would ever take for granted a certain amount of funding. Every year, you know, the council, just like every other agency, goes in and has a conversation with the legislature about what it needs to fulfill its constitutional and legal responsibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These are difficult times, too.
And those conversations have gotten quite detailed and very, very intense this year.
Yeah. No doubt, as they are for all agencies.
Of course.
So now the council is involved in selecting from a group of applicants for our Alaska Supreme Court. Can you tell us a little bit about how after an applicant fills out their 25-page application, what happens next?
Well, what happens next is quite detailed, and sometimes when I talk about it, people's eyes glaze over a little bit because it's so it can be tedious, the tediousness of the investigation. I mean, if there's anything I'd like the listeners to take away, it's how detailed and thorough the investigation of the applicants is. So, you know, we go back to every employer, every legal employer they've ever had, and we ask for an employment verification. We ask every attorney in the bar association, the Alaska Bar Association, to fill out a survey, rating each applicant on their legal ability, their temperament, their integrity, many different factors. We go and ask people who have appeared against them in cases to fill out a detailed questionnaire about how did they perform in that case. Were they pleasant adversaries? Were they not so pleasant?
And were they prepared?
Were they prepared is a big one, a very big one. Are they diligent? This is a huge question because judges have big caseloads. There's a lot of work to be done, and you really need an attorney in there who is used to, you know,
moving it along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At the same time, though, temperament's very important. It's one of the most important things. Is the person going to be able to, you know, what are the qualities we look for in a good judge? Is the person going to be able to go on the bench and even against all these time pressures, against the pressures of potentially people in the courtroom being very upset, maybe even acting out a little bit, will they still be able to maintain control and keep their temper and treat people with respect? Everyone is entitled to be treated with respect in the courtroom. It's very important.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you what judicial temperament, you know, that's one of the five or six things that the bar survey asks. And maybe there was a definition. I didn't go deep. But what does that mean? What does judicial temperament mean?
Well, I think it would be interesting to hear.
Take it right to the judge.
To hear Judge Andrews talk about her understanding, and then I can say mine.
Okay, that's great.
Well, I think probably the most important quality is someone who has patience. Patience is really, although you're moving cases quickly, it is a slower moving process because it's such a detailed process. And so you have to have patience in order to make certain that all sides get heard in a meaningful way. So you can't, unlike Judge Judy, you can't just rudely cut people off. And
enough from you.
Yes. So, but you do have to keep things moving. So I would say, in terms of a judicial temperament, you would look for someone who has patience and the willingness to listen, the ability to make decisions, and the converse of that, the willingness to ask to reflect upon your decision, because oftentimes a judge will make a decision and a lawyer will say, I'm going to make a motion for reconsideration. I think you made a mistake. I think you fail to understand this case or this fact, and so the willingness of a judge to reconsider a decision that they thought that they were right when they made it. This is not an appeal, but this is as the judge is making the decisions or shortly thereafter, within 10 days, people can ask for reconsideration. Mm-hmm. And the willingness to look at yourself and to look at your process and say, no, I actually think I did the right thing, or you know what? You're right. I actually overlooked something. I got carried away. I really want to stop. So it's that openness.
Is that hard? From personal experience,
yes, it's hard. It's not an easy.
Well, nobody
thing to
likes
do.
To be wrong. I mean, there's that human nature. But I thought it through. But that willingness to stay open.
And to stay open and to say you're this time you're right and I'm wrong. I actually failed to understand that piece of the case, or I misunderstood the expert's testimony. And now that you've pointed it out and I can see it in writing, you're right. I have to reconsider.
Yeah, that's so human. It just if you've just joined us, I just want you to know we're Hometown Alaska, but we have a special edition. This is Justice Alaska. It's our first one. We're going to do four this spring, one a month. And today's topic is how Alaska chooses its judges. And I have a co-host today, and a legal expert, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews, is with me. And we also have Suzanne DiPietro, Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. And we're spending the hour on this topic. I think that we should probably talk a little bit about the tensions around this. Alaska is somewhat unique. There are other states that have judicial councils, but I think I read maybe 16 or something like that. There's many ways of doing this. As you opened the show, Suzanne, talking about coming from a state where they are elected. Mm-hmm. Our Constitution set it up so that it's a merit-based system and we don't have elections. So, but there's still people who foresee change or would like change. And, you know, it's a public agency. You probably get questions. Or mm-hmm. what are some of the things people talk about?
Well, I think one of the most interesting or issues where the tension comes up is this idea of judicial independence and accountability. And so we want our judges to be independent because we want them to be able to follow the law and to make a decision that's correct with the law and the facts before them, even if perhaps the person in the courtroom is unpopular or unpleasant.
Talking about the person whose case this is.
Sure. Yeah. Uh-huh. Even if the person whose case it is right, unpopular, if the cause is unpopular, if the judge might, as a result of following the law, might be criticized in the press or by members of the public. And so that it's important when it's your case to know that the judge will follow the law. And if you're entitled to the decision in your favor under the law, that the judge won't be afraid to make that decision. So that's the independence piece. And it's very important. I think we would all agree if we could imagine ourselves in the courtroom, we wouldn't want the judge to make a different decision than we were entitled to because he or
by the
she,
law.
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
than we were entitled to by the law.
Yeah.
So that's one piece of it. But then people say, well, but judges can't be too independent. They need to be somewhat accountable. For example, they need to be able to take in, at least to understand in general public sentiment, those kinds of things. And so that's our the piece in our system where we have the retention election. That's mm-hmm. the accountability piece. But there is a real tension there. There are no pat or easy answers to the balancing of that. And other, you know, there are other sort of issues even within the way we think of the qualities of a good judge. You want a judge to be compassionate, but you also want a judge to be firm. So it's really, you know, when you think about everything that you're asking a judge to do and be, it's a very tough tough job, and really there's even contradictory impulses sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of the art versus the science of being mm-hmm. a judge, you know, the science of the law, but the art of the humanity of it.
Right. Yeah. It's really, it's a balancing act, yeah. And people have to, I think one of the things Elaine was talking about, that ability to really not let your ego get in the way if you're wrong, but also I think one important quality of a judge is the ability to reflect on how you may be coming off to other people in your courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
So
you may be absolutely right, but how is it playing?
How is it play? Or you know, you may be a person who, when they're listening when you're listening very intently, you sort of close your eyes or maybe gaze up or. You know, maybe you fidget, and people in the courtroom are perhaps looking at you thinking, this guy's not
checked
paying
out.
Attention.
yeah.
So that's, you know, again, that's not an easy thing to do, to self-reflect
right.
on how you appear to others and to make an effort to convey, you know, really what's going on.
Right. I'm going to throw out our phone numbers real quick just for folks. 550-8433 in Anchorage. 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Sorry, Elaine, jump in.
Yeah, so I have a question for you that I've always been sort of curious about. How does the judicial council go about what I would think would be a very difficult task to determine of the people who are applying to be a judge, especially if it's a case in which almost all the applicants are, by definition, not judges. They are they're lawyers, they're mm-hmm. advocates, and they're going to make a transition mm-hmm. to be a neutral. And very mm-hmm. tough to know in advance who mm-hmm. is going to make that transition successfully or not. Mm-hmm. So obviously, the judicial council gets applications. What happens after the application, and how do they go about kind of trying to ferret that out so that they send the name of the people who will do that best job to the governor? How does that process really work?
So, I mean, that really is the crux of it. So the council members have a lot of information from people who know the applicants, And so the people who know the applicants, who've worked with them, who've observed them, who've supervised them, who've litigated for and against them, these are the people who are saying to the council through comments, through bar survey scores, through a number of different ways, hey, I think this person is a great lawyer and could transition to be a great judge, or I think this person is a great lawyer, I'm not so sure they could be a great judge. Or this person actually is just kind of a mediocre lawyer, but I think they'd be a great judge. That third one I just kind of made up. That's not really what happens, but you could imagine. So the council members take all this into account. And then they do also have a lot of other information that I haven't even mentioned, but they do then interview the applicant. And that's one of the questions, obviously, that an applicant would be asked.
Right. Well, one of the things I found interesting was you're talking about people who might come into a who have come into a case, like social workers, police officers, all kinds of, you know, everyday people are asked to comment on people who have worked with this person. So, by the way, we have a phone call, so why don't we welcome, hello, Carl, you're on Hometown Alaska, Justice Alaska. What's your question?
All right. Well, thank you very much, Elaine Andrews, for being available. I feel like it might be a good opportunity to explore a number of things about the court system here in Alaska. My question has to do with sentencing. When somebody has been tried and convicted and is waiting on being sentenced or actually serving out the sentence, a case came up very recently in the press where somebody ran over a bicyclist, and this person was charged, went to trial and was convicted, but she's not serving any time yet, and the accident occurred almost 2 years ago now. And I'm wondering, is it proper for a judge to delay sentencing for a number of reasons? I guess this young lady is taking some classes and won't be done until May. Well, at that point, it's almost 2 years after the incident occurred. And what recourse does either the family or the public have when things like that happen that don't seem to make any sense? Somebody convicted a crime. They've been committed a crime, I'm sorry, and was convicted.
Right, Carl, we've got your question.
Okay, yeah.
We've got your question. So
think there are two questions here. One is, how does the sentencing process work and who's in charge of it and how does the timing go? And the other is, what do you do if you are unhappy with a judge's decision, not as a party in the litigation who has the right to appeal, but as a member of the public? So sentencing can take a long time, especially in felony cases where a pre-sentence report needs to be prepared. So a jury renders a verdict, and then the matter is set off for sentencing, and it's set off because we need a pre-sentence report, and depending on
what goes into that,
it is the pre-sentence reports are unbelievably complex, very detailed. It's assigned to a probation officer who then does many of the things that Suzanne talks about in terms of judicial applications. They investigate the person's criminal history. They get victim impact statements. They look at their criminal record. They gather a huge amount of information that actually may not have been available to the judge during the entire trial process. So it can be quite an endeavor, and it takes quite a while, depending on the case, to pull them together.
Is it public or is it always private?
No, those are not, because they oftentimes contain medical information, psychiatric information, information that is not available to the public generally. So the pre-sentence report needs to be prepared, and then a sentencing is set on. But of course, each side, both the prosecutor and the defense, need to get the pre-sentence report so that they can prepare sentencing memos for the judge. So this whole process, once again, it's complex. So it does take time. So the sentencing is oftentimes much later than the verdict. And I know that's a frustration. And sometimes sentencings get put off because something is in the pre-sentence report that people disagree with, and either side has the right to challenge it, and they need to gather information. So that's a long process. And then the sentencing occurs, and then the sentencing, someone might be out on bail, and then a date for remand or to go to jail needs to be set, or a person may be in jail awaiting sentencing. And of course, if they're in jail awaiting sentencing, the time that they're waiting counts towards their sentence. So that's the process. If, you know, if the parties, in other words, the person being sentenced or the state, thinks that the judge has made an error in the sentencing, they have the right to appeal a sentence. But the public certainly has the right to comment and to be concerned. And there are, I mean, the Judicial Council, as I understand it, takes letters from the public that will go into a judge's file to be looked at the time that the judge comes up for retention. If a member of the public thinks that the judge has actually committed some act that's unethical, as opposed to a judge just disagreeing with the judge's decision. But if you think that a judge has violated the code of judicial ethics, you can make a complaint to the Judicial Conduct Commission. So the public is not outside this process.
The process, yeah. So, we cannot comment on a particular case at all. We can only talk about the process. And part of why we're having this program is the process is complicated. And standing on the outside, you don't always know what the pieces are.
Right.
So,
yeah. And we're hoping to, you know, that the public will let us know what areas they really want to know more about, because everyone does better when we understand who's in charge of what pieces of this multi-piece system.
Right. And the other conflict we see all the time is people see things on television that are not the way the system actually works. It's more dramatic on TV, or it's faster, or it's judges are able to cut people off, or they don't have to have a very good judicial temperament or whatever. But the truth is, this show is about what it really takes to keep the judicial system working and doing the job that is fair to everybody.
So let me go back to Suzanne if I can,
sure,
and just
yes.
say once the Judicial Council interviews these applicants and decides, well, this person looks pretty good, what is their role? Do they send up one name to the governor? How does this work?
Right, we haven't talked about that. And actually, before the council, just on this issue of the public being involved, before the council interviews the applicants, it has a public hearing. And it conducts that public hearing wherever the vacancy is. So, for example, for the Supreme Court vacancy that we have right now, the council is going to be meeting at the end of the month, and there will be a public hearing when any member of the public can come and comment on the applicants. You know, the other thing members of the public sometimes do that I think the council members find quite helpful, especially in some of the smaller communities, is they might come and say, here are the qualities that I think you should be looking for in a judge for this community.
Oh, yeah.
In this particular community, we really value the quality of, let's just say, we have a very, you know, the court system is very clogged here, and we would really, really value the quality of diligence. And so we'd like you, Judicial Council, to really put that up towards the top of your list. So that's very helpful as well. So the public does have a role in the council's process, either at the public hearing, or of course we'll take letters at any time about anyone who's applied to be a judge, and we'll put those in the file for the council members' review. And so, but then there they are. They've had the interview. They're sitting in the room, the council members are, and they have to start talking about who are the most qualified among these applicants. And that is the discussion they have. And they must send at least two names to the governor so that he has at least two to choose from, and that's under the Constitution. But the Judicial Council's bylaws say, and the framers of the Constitution were very clear that they wanted the council to send only the most qualified. So we have eight applicants for the Supreme Court. The council could send all eight names. It must send at least two names. But the discussion will be who among this group is the most qualified. And if the council would conclude that all eight are equally the absolute top, they theoretically could send all eight names. But typically the council sends two or more names. And actually, most of the time, the council does send more than two names. The times when the council doesn't sends only two names actually are usually in the smaller locations where there aren't as many applicants. So the council often sends more than two names, but must send at least two. And it's the most qualified among this group. So I'll just say one
sure.
for the last comment on that is just because a person's name isn't sent up doesn't mean they're not qualified. It just may mean that they're not, it would mean that they're not among the most qualified in that group of applicants for that particular vacancy.
Right. I remember the expression tall timbers.
The tallest timber.
Tallest timbers, which means in any group, there's going to be tallest timbers, and in another group, there's going to be other tallest. You know, it just depends on the applicant pool and all kinds of things.
And sometimes judges have or applicants have been sent up for one position and not another.
Right.
And always the question is, well, you know, if I was qualified for one judgeship, why am I not qualified for the other? And each judgeship is different and each field is different. So
right,
maybe you're the tallest timber in one and there's a redwood.
There's
against
a really
you.
Big sequoia in the next.
I used to compete in foot races, and you know, I could do pretty well if the fast women didn't come to the race.
Exactly. So we're going to take a little break now. This is Hometown Alaska, but it's a special edition. It's Justice Alaska. We'll be back after a little break with Senior Judge Elaine Andrews and Suzanne DiPietro, Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. This is Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. This is a special edition of Hometown Alaska. We're doing Justice Alaska, the first of at least four of these programs we're going to do once a month, trying to bring a consumer approach to the legal system, almost inspired by Line One, your health connection. You know, this is Line One, your legal connection. But there's so much to talk about, and we have many ideas, and Elaine Andrews has many ideas, Suzanne DiPietro has many ideas, and others who are collaborating on this have ideas. But we'd also like to know what you'd like to know. One of the things we talked about was, how do you know when you need a lawyer, you know, or, you know, just how does a case work? You know, how does a court case actually work? Who's responsible for what pieces of it? There's just a lot. It's a complex system. So
I think that the public appreciates what the justice system does when they're confronted with a need. But when you step back and see how broad the topics areas are, I mean, people think of the courts as really sort of criminal justice, and that's the main thing they think about. But courts are places where juveniles are dealt with who are abused and neglected, where, you know, we have to take a look at contested wills, where we have to talk about the protection of the elderly. We deal with domestic violence, mental illness and commitments. The topics are incredibly wide-ranging: custody, divorce, property,
immigration.
Immigration is federal.
Federal.
That's one of the few things we don't deal with.
Okay.
But actually, and that really what Elaine was saying, that a Superior Court judge in Alaska has such broad general jurisdiction. They're hearing so many different kinds of cases. One of the things that the council members have to take into account when they're trying to fill a Superior Court judgeship is, what is the experience that this lawyer has had? Has this lawyer practiced in all these different areas? Domestic relations, criminal, probate, child in need of aid, delinquency, general civil, torts, contracts, that kind of thing. And so that's one of the issues for an applicant. Not only what has their experience been, but could they learn a new area of the law? Mm-hmm. How would they learn a new area of the law? How mm-hmm. would they study? How fast could they get up to speed? These are all things that you might not think of that the council members have to consider when they're trying to decide who would be the best for mm-hmm. this spot.
How long have you been the executive director, Suzanne?
I've been the executive director for just going on 3 years
I was just wondering if you ever get a judge who successfully, you know, starts the job and then decides, oh, I don't really like this. Has that ever happened?
You know, I think
Because it's hard.
It is hard. And it's a really hard job. Yeah. I think that people sometimes get into the job and think to themselves, wow, I didn't know I'd be doing this much domestic relations, or I knew I would be doing a little bit of this, but I didn't know it would feel like this, or it would be like this. I think our judges really, really feel honored to be on the bench, and it's a hard job, but they're really, you know, just to a person, honored to serve, which isn't to say that they completely adore every aspect of their job as much as every other aspect. There are definitely, you know, things that are quite hard.
Yeah. You want to jump in there, Elaine?
Well, I would agree with all that. But I want the public to understand how the process of selecting and evaluating judges kind of comes full circle. So, mm-hmm. So when the council sends up the names of qualified people to the governor, does the governor have a timeline? Can the governor pick whoever he wants from that pool? Could the governor pick someone who was not sent to him?
And that's a great question, especially in contrast to the federal system, where we don't really have a timeline, as I understand it, at least not one that's obvious to observers. But our timeline is quite clear. It's set in the law. So as soon as the Judicial Council sends the names of the most qualified to the governor, he has 45 days in which to appoint. So that's for planning purposes, that's quite nice to know for the court system. The court system knows when it's going to get the name of the governor's choice. And the Judicial Council also, as I mentioned, has certain timelines within which it has to do its work.
Mm-hmm. You know, one question I had is, so we were talking about the tall timbers, which is the best applicants in this pool. And so I'm wondering if someone goes up and say they have somebody's got 100%, somebody's got 99%, somebody's got 98%. Is the governor required to take the 100%, or they're all equal in
at that point, he has the most qualified people, and it is his choice, really. You know, I like to think that he doesn't have a bad choice at that mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. He's got at least two names. He's usually got more. All of them are among the most qualified, and he could use any criteria that he wished mm-hmm. to choose.
Yeah. And I think that that's part of the beauty of the system is that, you know, the governor is elected, so he mm-hmm. represents the people of the state.
Exactly.
And in reading through the materials, I actually was surprised to see that about 37% on average of the applicant pool gets sent to the governor. So mm-hmm. so there really is that public participation through the governor making the selection. So
Right. And actually, even reading the minutes of the Constitutional Convention, it was really important to the Judiciary Committee that the governor have a role. The role of the executive was very important to them. But they just wanted to make sure that the governor chose from a slate of the most qualified that could be given.
You know, I wanted to point out that on our website, I found this. There's little videos of three of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention talking about why this was important. And I really commend that to anybody if they sort of want to understand where this came from. It's these guys are still alive as far as mm-hmm. I certainly recognize them. And, the gravity with which they thought this through is pretty impressive. So, you know, go to hometown at alaskapublic.org. You can find that. We have a list of links there, and mm-hmm. there is one there. And it's pretty impressive. And it's only since 1959. We're so young. Mm-hmm.
And actually, right along those lines, I have to say that normally I would think that reading the minutes of the Constitutional Convention couldn't be more boring. But I have to say, when I went in to study those minutes, I was so impressed by the quality of the oration and the thoughtfulness.
Yeah, yes. It's inspiring.
It really is.
It calls out the best in us.
It makes me proud.
And Kathleen, you were asking about, you know, if a judge decides, well, this isn't exactly what I had in mind. I mean, judges do resign. They simply, they're not required to serve a minute longer than they want to. So mm-hmm. Judges decide mm-hmm. enough is enough,
right.
And they resign. They are required, unlike federal judges, they are required to retire at 70. So we have a mandatory retirement age, mm-hmm. unlike the federal system, which is a lifelong appointment, which ours is not, uh-huh. and there's no mandatory retirement age. So, you know, mm-hmm. we have lost some very fine jurists mm-hmm. because they turn 70, and that's it.
And you hate to see them go,
those are the rules. Yeah. And
I'm going to tell you that there's an email here that someone is having a listening party for the kickoff of the series. And they have a few questions. So let's go ahead and take them. Does that sound good to you?
Sure.
Could you please clarify when and where the public hearing will be for the Supreme Court? Supreme Court opening.
Yes, the public. So this is Suzanne. The public hearing will be on Tuesday, the 29th of March, and it will be in the Supreme Court courtroom in the Boney Courthouse at 303 K Street in Anchorage.
And that has capacity for as many people who want to come, or is it? It's not a.
It's quite a large courtroom.
So it's easy for anyone who wants to come and
yes,
watch.
Please.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Could you please explain what happens at a public hearing for judicial openings?
At a public hearing, the Judicial Council members are all present. They sit usually at the front of the courtroom or just somewhere where they can talk to the audience. And they say usually a little bit about their process. And then they just invite public testimony from anybody who wishes to speak. Sometimes there are many people there and only a few want to speak and many more want to listen. Occasionally, everybody wants to speak. So if there's a large crowd, sometimes there'll be a time limit. Mm-hmm. Just so that the council can get through everyone's comments and that everyone can have a chance. So that's how the process works.
Do they ever have to hold over the hearing and have a second day because there's so many people who want to talk?
That has not happened, although that would be a fine thing to have the public that yeah. involved, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. One more question. How many judges are up for retention and what judicial districts will be impacted? And how can voters find more information to make informed decisions? That's a three-parter.
That is a three-parter.
That's an important piece for this year,
right,
though. We
right.
have how many judges are up for retention this year?
So eligible to stand for retention in November of 2016 will be 41 judges statewide. Now, not everyone has to vote on all 41. So don't.
That would be overwhelming.
Voters do not panic. However, we have four appellate judges up for retention, and those will be voted on by everybody statewide. And then each judicial district, we have four judicial districts in Alaska, has a certain number of judges standing for retention. And the third judicial district, which includes Anchorage and South Central, essentially, has, I believe, over 20 judges who will be on the ballot. So a voter who's coming into the booth, I mean, you've got to imagine, you know, coming into that booth and you know, have you researched all the judges? Look in the voter pamphlet. The Judicial Council will have a lot of information and its recommendations to the voters about whether the council believes those judges are qualified or not. There's also a page in the pamphlet from each judge. A judge can put their own information in there. And or you can go to the council's website and delve deep into the charts and the graphs and
the math.
There is math. Yes.
Well, you know, when you said the Judicial Council puts forward the tall timbers, as we've been saying, mm-hmm. but they are looking at this bar survey. They're looking at the application. They're looking at all the responses of the app. It's mm-hmm. it's not just them deciding who they basically
no.
have to, as we said, deliver the highest mm-hmm. qualified.
Quality.
Applicants.
I think the key here and what the council strives for and, you know, what we all struggle with is to get the qualities, the most objective qualities that we can all agree on are good qualities for a judge. Mm-hmm. And how do you measure those? And so the council actually was the very first in the nation to establish a judicial performance evaluation process. And our process, because I serve on a national work group that looks at judicial performance evaluation, and ours is, I'm going to say, the most detailed of any in the nation. And certainly we were the first. Mm-hmm. And we've had a long time to get it right. And I think the council members feel that our evaluation process is quite thorough and it tries as much as possible to look at objective criteria that can be measured.
So for retention, it's a much broader segment of the public that the council is looking at. So
right.
my understanding is that in retention, a judge is not only evaluated by lawyers, but by police officers,
right.
social workers,
oh.
jurors.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. And we've been a little bit talking about selection and retention together. And
right.
so we should really separate the two procedures. They're similar, but there are big differences. Now, for retention, so a person who's already a sitting judge, there will be a lot of people who have been able to observe that judge's performance and give feedback to the council. And that's the list that Elaine was referring
okay.
to. Lawyers will be able to give feedback who've appeared in front of the judge. And so we ask the ones who've actually appeared and, you know, had direct professional experience with the judge what they think. And these are going to be, don't forget, people who won their cases and lost their cases. So you're going to get the full picture.
Wasn't there a second thing there where if it didn't go to trial?
Right. So that's right. So a lawyer may only have had some motion work with the judge, may only have decided a motion. It doesn't mean that they had to have been in the courtroom, but they had to have a good direct basis to evaluate that judge's performance. And then, though, who else is in the courtroom? Well, peace officers, police officers, probation officers are in the courtroom. They observe the judge's performance. Jurors observe the judge's performance. We survey them. Social workers often are in the courtroom on these child in need of aid cases and other types of cases. We survey them to get their feedback. And also we survey court employees, because a court employee will be able to see the judge's performance, as we might say, in the back office. So the police officers, the jurors, those people see the judge's performance in the front office in the courtroom, but the court employees see other aspects of the judge's performance.
What is Court Watch? I saw it's some sort of independent group that you also touch base with. Who are they?
So there was, unfortunately, Court Watch lost its funding, but what the Court Watch used to be citizens who were recruited and trained to go into the courtroom and really just evaluate the judge's performance, you know. Did the judge speak loudly enough? Was it clear what he or she was saying? Did he move the courtroom? Did he move the proceeding along? Those kinds of things.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, since there are so many judges on the ballot, and there's a lot to learn.
Yeah.
Is there a shorthand? I mean, does the Judicial Council come up with a recommend to be retained or not retained? Is there some way that that the public can, knowing how the process works, that they can say, well, what did the Judicial Council say about this person?
Exactly. So it's really nice for the public, because if you're the type of person who wants to go directly to the source materials and read it all yourself, we post all the judicial evaluation materials on our website. But if you're the kind of person who would like to know what people who did study all the source materials think, the Judicial Council has the authority by law to make a recommendation to the voters, and it does make a recommendation.
Always makes
it. Always has.
Okay.
And so in the voter pamphlet, you'll see the Judicial Council's yes or no recommendation. We recommend that the voters retain or do not retain this judge.
Okay.
So that's it. It's an easy shorthand way, especially if there are 20 on the ballot, that you can just look at the council's recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And vote accordingly. Or if you'd prefer to figure it out yourself, you can go and get those materials right off our website.
Right. We've got another caller I'd like to welcome onto Hometown Alaska, Justice Alaska. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you. Great show, and I look forward to the series.
Good.
We are damn lucky in this state to have the system we have for selecting judges. The constitutional framework is, I think, maybe not unique, but really well thought out, and the way it's implemented by the judicial agencies produces a really high caliber of judges. And so I'm impressed with that.
Good.
I had one question, that there was a time when a judge had to withstand some late-breaking publicity about the judge's conduct, and I believe one of the judicial agencies, I'm not sure which, got involved in the campaign. That was controversial, and perhaps related to that or not, the legislature tried to change the structure of the number of representatives or the qualifications for one of the judicial agencies. Were those two issues related, and what's the status of that issue at this point? Thanks.
Suzanne's going to take it.
Okay, so this is Suzanne. So I guess I'm not totally sure which specific case you're referring to, but the council does sometimes recommend against the retention of a judge. Now, one thing that's important to know about judges is that even though they're on the ballot, they're not allowed by their code of ethics to campaign unless and until somebody campaigns against them. So that's the dynamic. So sometimes it might occur that a judge who's standing for retention is not campaigning at all because nobody has made a negative attack on him or her, and then a negative attack comes, and then the judge then does have the right to campaign, and that can happen.
And the problem, of course, is that oftentimes if an attack comes, it comes very late in the cycle.
Right.
And you know, and judges not being politically active are you know, severely disadvantaged by that.
And so maybe what the caller was thinking of is, you know, certainly a judge who had a positive recommendation from the counsel who was in that position would certainly get out there and want that information to be out there. Certainly the counsel, does put its information out there.
It's always out there.
It's always out there. In fact, the statute requires the counsel to make the information available to the voters, and so the counsel does that.
I believe it was a judge that was not recommended against retention, but it was kind of an attack campaign, as I recall, against the judge. And I thought the counsel actually ran ads to say, to be accurate, to provide facts. And that seemed above and beyond, but it was extraordinary circumstances as well. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, and I think that was a few years ago. And the council has in the past, really the council for years ran at, I mean, the question is, how do you get this information out to the voters,
challenge.
With or without a controversy, right? You put it on your website, okay, well, that's helpful, but really what you want to do is get that information. You want to push it out through, you know, through the newspapers or radio or things that cost money. And so the council for years did spend small amounts of money on outreach to get its message out. And so that was a subset of the council's activities and just really trying to get the information out to the voters.
Great. Does anybody dare to touch the question of legislative attempt to restructure the agency?
there have been attempts in the past, and there have been attempts in more recent times on the legislative attempt. I think is to change the composition of the Judicial Council, which is now evenly divided between lawyers and non-lawyers, with the Chief Justice as the ex officio chair of that group. And there have been legislative attempts to try and change the balance there.
I just want to say they shouldn't mess with it, and the public shouldn't let them, in my humble opinion.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, it's very interesting. This is where reading the Constitutional Convention minutes is so interesting, because the founders really thought long and hard about the structure they had. You know, they expressed very clearly their reasons for the council being the way it is.
Maybe this is terribly nerdy, but maybe we should get the link. Is it that accessible that we could actually put the link on our...
It's right on the Judicial Council website.
Okay.
So,
okay. Sure. Well, we'll get that on our link. If you really want to do your own homework and hear their own voices on why they did what they did, we'll get that on there for you. We've had a number of questions about current cases, and it's not something we can actually comment on. We're really trying to comment on process and explain process. One question that came in is a question about why at a particular hearing didn't a judge do more to move something along? And I feel like that touched a little bit on process, because people assume things that it's the, you know. So I don't know quite how to answer this. They just thought that the judge did not do more to move the case along when addressing the defendant. Now, I'm not giving you the case, and this person did not name the case either, but just said they felt like something was awry in the process that they were watching. And I just thought maybe you could speak to what's the judge's role? Is he supposed to move this thing along, or are there things he's waiting to have happen? Or is it too vague to even really?
Well, I think probably what's most important there is that the judge needs to be sensitive to the fact that people are attending the hearing who may not be sophisticated about the process. And I think if a member of the public leaves the courtroom with that feeling that there's something awry here, to some extent the judge has to take responsibility for failing to recognize that might have been a concern and addressing it. So, you know, oftentimes people are frustrated about the process. And it really is up to the judge to explain in very direct, easy-to-understand language, this is what we're doing today, and I really would love to have done everything else that needs to be done, but I can't because, you know, I'm waiting for a supplemental pre-sentence report. I can't because I'm waiting for a custody investigation to be completed. So I can decide property issues today, but I can't decide custody issues today. So it really is, I think, a good judge will try and explain and anticipate what the concerns are going to be of the parties before them and the public who's watching,
right.
so that people don't walk out shaking their head saying, what the heck happened there? I don't get it.
Right. Yeah,
and
that's
I think
a good point.
That's a great segue into, you know, a good judge really should try to explain. I mean, if somebody leaves the courtroom and doesn't understand, that judge probably didn't do as great of a job as he or she should have done. And going back to the judicial evaluation process, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about, we've been talking a lot about providing information to the voters, but of course the judges get this information as well. And so the judge may get feedback.
Feedback. It's sort of like an evaluation.
It's a performance evaluation, just like we all get at work, except probably more detailed, detailed than ones I've had.
Yeah.
And so the judge then has the opportunity, again, to self-reflect and say, oh, okay, well, I thought it was perfectly clear why we didn't move that along. But it turns out that people didn't understand or didn't agree. And, you know, I need to think about that and I need to think about how I can do it better next time. So the performance evaluation process is important for the public in terms of the retention election, but it's really important for the judges as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the judges really take those comments and evaluations quite seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very it's a job that you do by yourself in a courtroom, and
right.
So you don't get a lot of by definition you don't get a lot of feedback because it's not appropriate
right.
in many ways to give
right.
the judge the feedback. But the evaluation process does give the judge that information that uh-huh. can help their performance. I mean, judges right. are a little bit like teachers. They don't get to see other people who are teaching and judging. So
right.
It's,
you're in your courtroom
right.
or your classroom.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We've got another question here. We might have time to squeeze it in. Are the Supreme Court applicants' positions on abortion, tough on crime, et cetera, considered during the application process?
Oh, I'm so glad that question came. This is Suzanne. I'd like to answer that. No, actually not. The way a judge would rule or thinks he or she might rule on a particular case, as you can imagine, is not a fair criterion to evaluate whether they're qualified or not for the job because people have different opinions about those things.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, could the judge be fair? Could the person be open-minded? So is the person so wedded to a particular viewpoint that they couldn't set it aside to be fair, to hear the arguments of the people in front of them? That's the inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
Really going around, you know, second-guessing how people are going to rule. And, you know, it's very interesting. You know, I listened to a Supreme Court justice, he's retired now, testify. And, you know, he testified that it was very interesting for him. He thought sort of, you know, he sort of thought how he felt about something, a very important controversial issue. And then when he read all the briefing, the hundreds of pages of briefing, and he really sat down and talked about it, he came out the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So can a person do that? Even if they sort of have kind of an inclination, but can they sit down and wipe that slate clean, listen to the arguments, be totally fair and impartial? That's the inquiry.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. It's hard job.
Well, that's a very hard thing to do, and that's why it has to be such an intensive screening process, because we're really looking, the council's really looking for the people who can do that hard thing.
Well, I would invite our listeners, obviously they're very interested, send us your ideas of other future legal issues, judicial system issues that you'd like us to pick up. I'd like to thank Elaine Andrews and Suzanne DiPietro for being with us today and our listeners and callers. Next week, Charles Wolforth will be back as your host, coming to you as a new dog lover. He has a dog named Posey, and he's going to have a behavioral specialist on, so I have a feeling he's having adventures with his dog. Pat Yak is our Vice President of Public Media. Eric Bork is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.